Good morning. This is John Richardson speaking with you from Toronto, Canada. Today is Monday, November the 29th, 2021, and we continue this week again with our podcast series, Good and Evil, which is basically a discussion of Charles W. Adams' great book with that title, Good and Evil. And I am joined with my co-host in this, Jimmy Sexton, chief executive and founder of the Esquire Group in Dubai. And today we are also joined with a special guest, David Lesperance of Lesperance Associates, who I think I can say is based in Poland. And what Jimmy and David have in common is they both help people with money who need some kind of a life change, financial planning, some kind of insurance policy, perhaps a new and different actual and or tax residency. And that will make for a very interesting discussion today. So welcome back, Jimmy, and hello, David. Welcome. How are you today?
Very well. Thank you, John.
Doing great. Thanks.
All right. So as is our practice, we are continuing through Charles Adams' great lessons. This week we are on lesson 6, and I will begin by reading that, and then we will begin our discussion. So here we go. Nature will not bestow wealth equitably. A few citizens will inevitably acquire great wealth, which by natural justice they should share with the community. But this sharing should be enforced by moral persuasion and strong public opinion, not force and confiscation. Well, I think we can all agree that at a minimum, there's an awful lot of income distribution and further attempts at asset distribution going on today. Anybody disagree with that?
No.
No, I think that's pretty accurate.
All right. So really, you know, lesson 6 talks about two things. He attacks. So I think we all would agree that there are discrepancies in wealth, and that's perfectly normal. But the lesson seems to focus on sharing, distribution, which is voluntary, moral persuasion, and strong public opinion. And that's sort of, he's contrasting that with the force and confiscation. And it really seems to me that these days we've got a lot more of the force and confiscation going on than the moral persuasion and strong public opinion. Would you agree?
Yes, I think if we look at just the ongoing public relations battle between Senator Warren and Leon Cooperman, this is exactly what she's saying with her, you know, wealth tax. She's saying, give it to us, we're going to take it from you. And Leon Cooperman saying, I already pay a lot of tax. I really want control over the spending of that. And, you know, the man drives an 8-year-old Volvo, so he's not living kind of a high life. And you know, if you've seen him on TV, he's not exactly a fashion plate, but he spends a lot of money in various educational and medical philanthropy, and he wants to continue to control that.
So Jimmy, bringing Jimmy into the conversation here, I bet you that Jimmy might have an opinion on whether this kind of wealth is better exploited through the private sector or through government taking it. Am I right? You have a thought on that?
Absolutely. I mean, look, I think everybody can agree that governments are probably the least efficient organizations around. I mean, you just compare the post office with FedEx, right? I think that the private sector often does things much more effectively, much more efficiently. And what I think is so interesting is how governments paint these ultra high net worth people as sort of these really greedy people that want to hoard all their money for themselves and don't want to, you know, help anybody, which just isn't the case. I mean, a lot of them do huge philanthropic endeavors and really do some great things for society more effectively than governments. But, you know, the governments want the money to run the bureaucracy, not to help the citizens.
Well, that, you know, that's interesting because, You know, I think what you're alluding to is simply this, that when government redistributes it, it's redistributed for no purpose whatsoever. They just take it and they decide what they want to do with it. And we know from government that, you know, 9 times out of 10, it does get sort of eaten up in the bureaucracy. But, you know, if it's done through through private means, philanthropy, what have you, at least it is directed towards some kind of noble public purpose, right?
I would say so.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly occasions when people are using philanthropy to, we'll say, reputation wash, if we look at the Sacklers. But let's compare, let's look at malaria. In the 100 years since it discovered that mosquitoes were the vector for malaria, how much money was spent by numerous governments around the world? Yet one guy, Bill Gates, using only part of his assets, had more impact on that in a decade than all of those governments trying to do the same thing in the 100 years prior. That's a real practical example of effective and efficient use of money to solve a societal ill.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, and also, I mean, even if you look at, and this is specifically speaking about charities in the United States, you know, the government's put some pretty strong, I don't want to say controls, but there's some pretty strong monitoring that administrative expenses are not out of hand and that funds are actually going towards the cause. And, you know, that's exactly opposite with governments, right? I mean, very little bit goes towards the cause and most of it goes towards administration.
You know, you put it that way. And what I'm reminded of is a couple of years ago, I was looking at a GoFundMe site, right? Somebody was raised, I think it was somebody who was trying to raise money to study at Oxford or something. I just came across. It was somebody local to me. And I looked at this and I thought, you know, my initial thought was, I think I'll send a couple $100 or something like that. And then I looked at the amount that GoFundMe was taking off the top for this. And I thought, you know, and then I just sort of, you know, sent the person a message and said, you know, I do want to support you, but I don't want to do it through the GoFundMe. I'd rather just send you the money directly. You know, I assume you have no problem with that, right? You know, and obviously they had no problem with it. But, you know, you make a really important point that, you know, to the extent that government gets involved in this stuff, and you have an almost guaranteed extra administrative charge coming out of this, right?
Yeah, I mean, probably, I mean, I don't know exactly what the percentages are, but I mean, I guess the administrative charge of 80%, I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, and that's the efficiency problem. And there's the effectiveness problem. What are they monitoring? That which is not measured is not, you know, dealt with. Do they have any type of feedback loop? Are they reducing whatever the societal ill is? It's not effective. It's not efficient. Especially in targeted things. There are things which, you know, you need to, from a community point of view, pull together and fund. That may be a military or roads, et cetera. But even there, there's space for private sector. And are they making good choices, or are they making choices and spending that money to get elected or to get reelected, as opposed to dealing with a societal ill? And one of the things in one of your previous podcasts, you mentioned, for example, Switzerland and its wealth tax. And why is it working in Switzerland and why did it not work in France, for example? Well, in Switzerland, first off, the canton votes for the wealth tax. The canton collects it and the canton spends it. So the person contributing that literally drives over the bridge or past the school or the hospital every day. So they see their money at work, and therefore there's a lot more acceptance of it because they can see the impact of their contribution. Whereas, you know, when you're looking at large governments, the check goes out or the wire goes out, but there's no feedback as to what it was ever spent on and whether it ever dealt with, you know, a societal ill. You don't get to see the joy in the child's face when you hand them the scholarship, or the pain that's reduced for if you're contributing to a hospital or medical, or you don't see the impact.
Well, I would go even a step further. And I think that you see, especially with big governments, you see, and I mean, I'm not saying that this is necessarily not good causes, but you know, you see so much money get spent abroad rather than at home, right? And I mean, that really, I mean, especially if you look in the case of the US, I think that's really hard to get buy-in from your citizens to pay more money when the only thing you see on the news is money getting spent not only on wars, but foreign aid and everything else that doesn't directly improve anything at home, right? And I think that's a big problem too, is that, you know, a lot of what you see in the media is what this, what the tax dollars are doing abroad, but it's not doing anything for anybody at home.
You know, I think that's of course very true. It strikes me there's another issue here as well, and I see this worldwide. You know, I see it in the U.S., I see it in Canada. I don't want to give the impression I'm picking on any particular country. I mean, I think in this regard, you know, governments are pretty much the same. But you know, if you look at this Build Back Better Act or whatever this thing is called, right? And you know, so they have, you know, they say, well, we're going to give the IRS $80 billion, or we're going to devote, you know, $60 billion to broadband improvement or something. And, you know, and I wonder, where the hell do they get these figures anyway? I mean, do they just pull this out of a hat and say, well, you know, we're just going to throw some money in this? I mean, it seems to me that that's a huge difference between the way governments operate and the way the private sector would operate. I mean, with the private sector, it's not just, you know, you're trying to accomplish something. So I suppose you figure it out as you go along. You don't just earmark $60 billion to throw out the window, right? Or do you think I'm being too harsh?
Well, no. If you look at the budget process in a private sector, okay, here's the problem we're trying to solve. What are the various ways that we can deal with it? What are the budgets on that? What is the project management on that? Versus the you know, trading back and forth. Well, 60 million. No, I think 80 million. Oh, I think 40. There's, you know, it's just removed completely from, you know, is 40 million well spent, much more effective than 100 million well spent? Is you know, 60 million going to be enough? There just isn't any of that process because they're removed. They just want to, oh, gee, we just got to agree on something because the midterms are coming up, or, you know, it's another election cycle, or I have, you know, the motivations are, I've got to go out and raise more money for my campaign. It's not, is this the most effective and efficient way of dealing with this issue?
Well, certainly when you look at what's going on with governments, whether in the U.S. or Canada, I mean, let's shift to Canada for a minute. You know, I look at this stuff and it's very, very clear that the vast majority of these amounts and numbers are not at all well thought out. I mean, there's no real sense of how it's supposed to contribute to the end goal, right? But if you have, you know, a private group of people, determining, you know, sort of deciding on a goal and deciding how to raise money to achieve that. I mean, you've obviously got a better correlation between those two things. I mean, I think a great example is in Toronto, there's, you know, tons of condominiums, but there's also a fairly large number of co-ops. And, you know, with the co-ops, right, you know, there's a board. I mean, it's managed by the owners and they decide how much money they want to, you know, they need to achieve this, that, and the other thing. And with the condominiums, what they do is they go out and they hire some management company. And, you know, the stories about, you know, outright theft, favoritism, and everything, you know, in relation to these management companies are legion. But the point is simply this, that, you know, once you bring in a third party or entity or government or something, a new layer of bureaucracy, where many of those individuals can benefit personally by doing things that are not necessarily in the interest, right, of the end goal. I mean, I think, you know, you've clearly got problems.
Well, in strategic philanthropy, you're spending your own money, so you tend not to cheat yourself. Whereas, you know, the accountability is you're trying to accomplish a specific goal. You're going to be very careful to make sure that that is money well spent. You're going to be very careful to monitor the impact of that and adjust accordingly. on a budget, you're going to be constantly, you're going to engage in projections, which are based on the number of different factors, kind of what we'll call dynamic scoring, and you're constantly going to be monitoring and adjusting that scoring to try to get as accurate as possible. I mean, governments, they engage in, you know, the GAO, they do static budgeting, which are assuming that there's no, going to be no reaction. Well, you know, for every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. Of course, society, taxpayers, you know, the various people who are going to be impacted, there's going to be a reaction. So, you know, your numbers, if they're based on static budgeting, are ridiculous from the outset. And it doesn't make them any better that you don't have a lot of confidence in your first version of a static scoring. So the budget numbers are just not in any way based in reality.
Well, I think, sorry, John, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
I was going to say, I think one of the other issues is philanthropy is very targeted, right? And it's very long-term. Like, you can have a charity say, okay, we're going to try to tackle this issue. And then they tackle that issue over a long period of time because, you know, they're the governing body, normally, you know, the board of directors or whatever is focused on that, right? It's a long-term initiative. Whereas governments, you know, you keep having different people in charge every so many years with different priorities and promising different things. And all these initiatives get started and then they get sidelined and then they, you know, they still need to raise money to do a half-assed job of that while they're starting a new thing. And they don't stay most governments don't stay focused on something long-term enough to even finish the thing they announced that they were going to work on, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you look at an example, and going back to the rule, moral suasion versus compulsion, and you look at how was the giving pledge by Warren Buffett received? Quite well. How was the Buffett rule, which was an increase, a specific increase in taxation, received? Not well. So the moral suasion worked a lot better than the compulsion. And at what point, you know, compulsion, it ultimately comes to, you know, exit voice loyalty. So if I am a billionaire or not even a billionaire, but somebody of means who is looking at, you know, engaging in strategic philanthropy in activities and charities for which I have a great emotional attachment, to which I have seen the impact of, and I want to continue to see the impact, the positive impact of that. And the money is going to be taken away, so I'm not going to fulfill those commitments. Well, I have three choices. I can loyalty, suck it up, and thank you very much, government, whatever it is, here's the money. I guess it's not going to go to my charity. I can engage in voice. I can engage in lobbyists who may or may not have an impact on this, or I can exit and I'll leave. Thank you very much. And I don't need to follow, you know, your 501c or whatever the relevant rules are in whatever jurisdiction you are, rules. And I can spend it as I see fit and in a manner and at a speed which I think appropriate. And so a lot of clients are actually choosing that option. I'm finding it's been a major motivator for the Americans expatriating that I've seen in the last couple of years.
Okay, so to be a little more clear, the major motivator is?
The major motivator is have control over strategic philanthropy.
Right, okay.
So again, if you look at the discussion between or the debate between Senator Elizabeth Warren and the hedge fund manager Leon Cooperman, that was really what it was about. She wanted to basically grab the money and be able to spend it to, you know, whether it was actually going to. She was naming, oh, these are all, you know, puppy dogs and rainbows kind of things. Okay, great. But how exactly are you going to impact that? Whereas Leon Cooperman is saying, I am giving hundreds of millions of dollars for medical treatment. I am giving hundreds of millions of dollars for scholarships. Thank you very much. I'm already doing that. And there's a guy who just doesn't live large, generally speaking. So sure. It's not like you can point at, you know, a super yacht or any of those things. And he said, thank you very much. I pay a lot in taxes. I wanted to go. And instead of engaging in, you know, moral suasion, she put, you know, coffee mugs on her website on billionaires tears, because the guy was very emotional, passionate about these things. Will a 79-year-old Leon, my apologies if I get his age wrong, Cooperman pick up and move from the United States? No, but a lot will, and a lot are. And I'm just seeing that as a major kind of motivation.
Isn't the debate here, the Elizabeth Warren thing, I mean, isn't this really the difference between just taking for the sake of taking and helping for the sake of helping?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, she's pretty thin, you know, we're spending it on good stuff, but it, and the debate really moved from we're taking money for good stuff to we're taking money from bad people. And my clients are saying, well, I don't really remember being bad. I don't remember, John, the night that I woke up and Steve Jobs had a gun to my head and said, Apple or die, or, you know, Bezos said, join Prime or the kids have it. I mean, they offered goods or services which I found were worth more than they were asking for in price. And as a result of global markets, et cetera, they did fairly well, and or did very well, and bully for them.
But your point is that a number of these kinds of people, I mean, I would agree with you, are basically looking to create different living opportunities, which would include the opportunity to control the kind of gifting that they want to do through second citizenships or, you know, what have you.
Yeah. And if you look at just impact on mankind, can come in a lot of ways. It can come from donating for medical research. It can come from making something that's extraordinarily expensive but important, such as space travel, more effective and more efficient. I listened to Elon Musk. I hadn't really appreciated. He was interviewed in recently in a code convention, where he was explaining the effectiveness and efficiency and the cost effectiveness of the Dragon 2 and all the things that he's done. I mean, basically 10 times the payload at 1/10 the price. Well, that's a huge benefit. And I'm sorry, you know, like nobody said anything when young Elon, who was born with a South African and a Canadian passport because mom was a Canadian, decided it's in his best interest to move from South Africa to go to Queen's University in Canada. And nobody, you know, questioned his decision to move from Canada to go to MIT. He thought that was in his best interest. Nobody questioned his decision to move to Silicon Valley to start Exco, which eventually became PayPal. And stuff, but when he moved from California to Texas, which he viewed in his best interest, people lost their minds. Now, you know, and Elon, you know, like many, John and Jimmy of us in this field, or somewhere on the spectrum, he obviously doesn't really care that much about or really identify that much with how society views his actions. And so the guy's already loaded with a South African Canadian passport. He could renounce his citizenship, pay his deemed disposition, his so option one.
Let's could be the best he ever made.
Let's compare to the Wyden's ultra-millionaire tax. So Wyden wanted to have a deemed disposition on all his capital gains. And then you stay in the system and keep paying every year.
Well, that's what John and I
7A and be done.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, Jimmy, go ahead, Jimmy.
No, I was saying that John and I were talking about that. I don't know if it was the last time or a couple of times ago that we were saying it, if you have to pay the tax anyway, you might as well just pay it and leave. What's your motivation to stay on the hamster wheel?
Yeah, gentlemen. I mean, what has been the major obstacle for clients emotionally for them to expatriate? The deemed disposition. Well, Wyden just said, we're going to force a deemed disposition on you, and we're going to keep you in the game. So thank you very much. You just eliminated the single largest emotional barrier we had to hiring the three of us.
Well,
I mean, not just emotional barrier. I mean, financial
barrier.
Barrier, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, you know, I would put it even more simply, the way I look at this is, you know, the ultra wealthy, I mean, they may have dodged the bullet temporarily. They may have dodged the bullet temporarily, but once these things, you know, become sort of accepted part of discussion, sooner or later, they're going to be back. And, you know, I'm inclined to think that these very, very wealthy people in the United States basically should see the payment of that exit tax the single best financial investment they could ever make, because it's a question of, are they going to lose only a quarter, or are they going to lose everything? Because believe me, if they stay in this, they will lose everything.
Yeah, I've been using the analogy that it's kind of like being in a tax the rich wildfire zone. And so what do when you're in that kind of zone? Well, you engage in fire prevention, which would be the normal domestic tax planning. That may be a GRAT, that may be a charitable remainder trust. Again, we're using American examples here, or tax harvesting, et cetera. But you also get fire insurance, alternative citizenship, alternative residence, and you map out a fire escape plan. If the fire gets too close, an asset by asset, you know, what's the expatriation, both the deemed disposition and the other, you know, stinger in the tail with regards to leaving assets to U.S. persons in the future. And a lot of clients, and when we look at the ultra-millionaire tax, it didn't die. It just became an ember with a little bit of oxygen that flares back up again. So, you know, the case to have a fire insurance at the minimum and to map out a fire escape plan. And a lot of clients are saying, I smell smoke. And so, you know, you don't wait till the fire marshal confirms your house is ablaze before you get fire insurance or trigger your fire escape plan. So that's it.
Yeah. I have a question for both of you. And that is, you know, as you were saying, David, which I think is very true, right? I mean, the biggest barrier to expatriation for extremely wealthy people is the exit tax, right? I mean, that can be very costly if you have highly appreciated assets. Are you seeing, and this is for both of you, are you seeing as the tax, the rich stuff gains steam and gets a little bit more crazy, that you're seeing the wealth level of people willing to pay that expatriation tax increase? That basically you're seeing wealthier and wealthier people increase because they see the danger increasing, or you see it remaining about the same for the time being in your own practices?
I'm seeing it increasing, and also because interest rates are so low that the problem with the deemed disposition is you need real money by the following April 15th in order to pay the tax. And with interest rates so low, people can borrow against the assets to pay the tax, and then they're done. So I think it's a combination of smelling the smoke, and with interest rates being so low, being able to come up with the liquidity, you know, because a lot of these clients may not want to sell positions, particularly if that's a control issue. They obviously think they have good stuff. And if they're founders, they want to, you know, they may not want to sell shares because of a control issue. They can borrow against it and pay the tax, and then they're done. I mean, if you look at Eduardo Saverin, yeah, he paid a tax upon expatriation, but that's a rounding error. I mean, he was 32 years old when he renounced. Average American male lives to 76. That's 44 years of net equaling gross. With no income cap gain gift or estate tax, you know, his exit tax was a rounding error compared to future tax savings.
Yeah, I really have come to, my thinking on this has evolved over the years to the point where I feel very strongly that for a lot of people, paying the exit tax may be the single best financial investment they could ever make at this point. you know, partly as a matter of principle, partly as a matter of, you know, my sense of where things are going, and partly, David, for the reason that you give, you know, it's relatively speaking less expensive. But to answer the question, you know, that Jimmy poses, I'm seeing right across the board a lot of interest in getting out of this. And, you know, leaving aside the issue of high net worth people who would have to pay an exit tax, what I'm seeing an increase in is people who are becoming aware of the exit tax have net worths of around $1.8 million and are waking up to, oh my God, I can get out now before this thing kicks in. I'm seeing a lot of that as well.
I was going to say with inflation, $2 million, you know, is getting pretty easy to hit.
Yeah, I mean, look, God rest her soul, both of my grandmothers had $2 million in assets when they passed, and they weren't
they didn't see themselves as wealthy at all.
Well, no, they just had land that, you know, city grew out to where their farmland, and there
you go. Well, that's exactly right. You know, we were talking about Toronto, David's recent visit to Toronto before starting this thing. I mean, so David, you would agree that, you know, anybody who owns a house in downtown Toronto and who has a pension from 30 years of employment is almost certainly above that $2 million. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you have a condo with two bedrooms, you're at that. And you know, I started, you know, way back when dinosaurs roamed the earth, and John, you and I were the dinosaurs. You know, I articled at a firm in, this is getting very local now, but in Mississauga, where north, a kilometer north, there was nothing but farm fields. Well, now that's all solid suburbia. Yes. And so the people that own those farms, they're, you know, if not hundreds of millionaires, you know, possibly billionaires. And if you just had, you know, some small holding, if you bought a house and held on to it for, you know, if you were an immigrant that bought a house in certain neighborhoods in Toronto 50 years ago for $50,000, that house is worth $3 million now.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the only issue is the frontage. Is it 20, 25 or 30 foot frontage? I mean, that's the only issue on the land.
But Canada, up to this point, still has a principal residence exemption and an unlimited principal residence exemption.
Wow.
And things.
Well, so, this is, of course, the big problem, or not the a big problem for dual citizens living in Canada is that, you know, as David would, I think, attest to that, you know, one of the main forms of financial retirement planning in Canada, or at least for people in Toronto and Vancouver, is, you know, that they'll cash out of their house that's worth a couple million dollars. And to be clear for people listening, these are not mansions. This is what it costs to own a house, you know, to live in, right, in these cities. So what they'll do is they'll cash out and, you know, they'll move, you know, 300 kilometers away, you know, and sort of, you know, live off their capital to some degree. But as U.S. citizens, they can't do that. And this,
they got,
you know,
a cap on the principal residence exemption.
Well, it's an irrelevant cap at $250,000. I mean, it's completely irrelevant. You know, you go back to, you know, say Warren Buffett's "My favorite holding period is forever." You know, I mean, this completely distorts that principle, right? For, you know, Americans, they need to move every few years.
Yeah.
You know, it's a terrible, terrible thing.
Well, gents, we're up on the 5 minute mark here, so I think we need to wrap up our very enjoyable conversation.
Well, Jenny, yeah. I'll throw this in your direction then. I mean, what do you think? I mean, I feel as though we are just caught in the vortex of a world that is completely spinning out of control. It's almost impossible to provide advice that, you know, because you can't predict the future all that well. It's very, very difficult to provide really good advice other than, I think, prepare yourself for instability, right? And do the best you can in that regard. So, you know, maybe as we bring this to an end, Jimmy, if you agree with that, I mean, what are your thoughts? What would you tell somebody to prepare for the instability? Somebody walks into you and says, "Hi, I'm 45 years old. I've got a few million bucks. I'm worried about all of this. What should I do?" What would you say?
Well, I mean, I think both of you would agree with this, but I think as you said, yeah, I mean, prepare for instability. I think you got to have a some type of structure in place that's flexible. You have to be nimble. You have to have some liquidity so you have the freedom to move around. You need to have more than one passport so you have the freedom to move around, and you need to set up residency and tax advantage places. And you kind of got to keep your eye on how things are changing and be willing to change with the times as certain places become more advantageous and others become less advantageous.
Yeah, you know, you put it that way reminds you, I don't know who it was said, it's not the strongest who necessarily survive, it's the ones who can best adapt to change.
Agreed.
I mean, certainly not the strongest people on the planet. You know, I don't know. So what do you think, David? I mean, you know, so you get these people calling you up, I know, and saying, my God, what should I do?
Well, I think they need to give themselves optionality, like Jimmy said. You need to be aware of the dangers. You need to give yourself as many options as possible, put as many kind of arrows in your quiver. For Americans, alternative citizenship is really necessary and alternative residence. And so, you know, for the people who, and because all the Americas were really immigration destination countries during the 19th and 20th centuries, a lot of clients have claims to lineage citizenships, and they should really be looking at that. And I can't tell you how many people who said, oh yeah, you know, my second cousin's brother looked at it 30 years ago. Well, you're assuming A, he got the correct answer, and B, you're assuming nothing's has changed. So given the value of this, you know, it's worth kind of checking out those things, but getting yourself the fire insurance and, you know, contemplating a fire escape plan, just to deal with and watching the wildfire to see, you know, how is this going to impact your life, and getting out before the flames are kind of licking at your toes.
Yeah. You know, I think what I would say is I think this, I mean, I agree with obviously everything that each of you has said. But the first point I would make is, and I think this is a big mistake people make, is they always assume that tomorrow is going to be like today, right? And I think the first point is there's no guarantee, and I think it's unlikely that tomorrow will be like today. I mean, let me just ask the two of you, could you even conceive 10 years ago, could you conceive that the three of us would be doing a podcast on this topic?
No, with you in Toronto, Jimmy in Dubai, and me in Poland, no.
No, I mean, more than that, I mean, just the sort of, you know, the level of instability. And I think the second piece of advice I would give is, you know, keep your life simple, look for ways to live simply and inexpensively and be happy. Because one thing that is very, very clear is that these governments are going to be shining a light more and more on anybody who they think has more than somebody else, because they know, to go back to the Charles Adams thing here, that nature does not and will not bestow wealth equitably. And that's what governments are about, okay, to try to somehow remedy that. A fool's errand, maybe, but that's certainly what they're doing. Coordinates, where would people get a hold of you? David, let's start with you.
They can go to my website, Lesperance Associates. There'll be contact. There's lots of information, lots on the blog and in the media section if they want to reach out. There's a contact sheet there.
And this podcast eventually too, right?
And of course, this podcast will be like your previous interviews on the media section.
All right. Jimmy, how would they get a hold of you?
Check us out at EsquireGroup.com or shoot us an email at info@EsquireGroup.com.
All right, that's great. And for those who don't know me, I'm John Richardson. You can find me at citizenshipsolutions.ca. Well, thank you both. Another, you know, when I start these things off every Monday, I never know which way, where they're going to go, because the topics are so interesting. And once again, great discussion. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.